following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
So who actually reads those terms of service on your phone or your computer before you accept them? Okay. Several weeks ago, I asked that question when our study of the book of Ezra brought us to a chapter full of genealogies. And let's be honest, okay? Most of us, when we come to those sections, if you're reading your Bible and you come across one of those, we skip right over it, don't we? That's the kind of stuff you say for late at night when you're fighting insomnia, right? But the problem is when you skip over chapters like that, sometimes you may also be skipping over some bit of valuable insight that's buried deep in that list of who begat who. There's a similar issue at play in the chapter we're looking at today from the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 3. And I encourage you, if you have a Bible, to turn there, because it's going to make it a lot easier to follow along. We're not going to read the whole chapter, but we're going to be dipping in and out. If you didn't bring a Bible, we have some in the pews in front of you, and you can feel free to borrow one of those this morning. But you'll want to have it open at Nehemiah chapter 3 to follow along with us. And what you're going to see if you glance over that is this really reads like a whole bunch of work assignments. This person built that. This person built this. And it's not the most exciting stuff to look at first glance, okay? In fact, when Chuck Swindoll wrote his best-selling book on Nehemiah back in the late 70s, he totally skipped this chapter. He didn't even touch it. On the other hand, the venerable preacher James Montgomery Boyce says that Nehemiah chapter 3 could be one of the most important chapters in the book. All right, so how do you square that? Who's telling the truth here? Well, when you try to read Nehemiah 3, it's really easy to get kind of bogged down in the multiple descriptions of who was building what. But if you zoom out a little bit and look at the big picture, look at the passage as a whole, then what you begin to notice are some insights about how a rich, diverse group of people, each with their own agendas and interests, nevertheless came together to do something truly remarkable. You'll remember Nehemiah came to Jerusalem in the late 5th century BC to rebuild the city's walls that had lain in rubble for over 150 years. Those walls represented protection to the city, but they also represented prestige to the city. And even more than that, they represented an identity because they demarked the people that live within these walls. These are the people who live in covenant with the one true God, as opposed to those who are living outside of that special relationship. So the walls were a powerful, powerful symbol. Now Nehemiah came, as we saw last week, he inspected the problem, he came up with a plan, and he cast the vision before the people. And he acknowledged, honestly, the challenges that were there in rebuilding the walls. This was not going to be an easy task. But he also reminded the people of the resources that were available to them, not only by the king of Persia, but also, and more importantly, by the king of heaven. And so he called on the people to meet the challenge. And meet the challenge they did. In Nehemiah 2 verse 18, you'll remember we read where the people stood up and they said, "Let us arise and build." And they weren't just talking, because they were told next, so they put their hands to the good work. Chapter 3 is all about how they did that. And as we face the challenge of rebuilding our ministries in this crazy, crazy era that we live in, there's a lot we can learn from here. I found at least 8 insights that helped me. Maybe there's more, but we're going to focus on these 8 things that we can learn this morning when the people of God come together to rebuild. And one of the things that happens when the people of God come together to rebuild these walls is they kept God's redemptive mission in the forefront. In verse 1, we read, "Then Eliashib the high priest arose with his brothers the priest and built a sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall to the Tower of the Hundred, to the Tower of Hananel." I don't think it's an accident that they began the reconstruction project where they did. Usually in a writing like this, whoever gets mentioned first, that's a place of honor. And we're told the work began with a section of the wall that surrounded what was known as the Sheep Gate. Now, what we see in this description, this whole chapter, is they begin at the Sheep Gate. And then if you know anything about the geography of the ancient city of Jerusalem, they work in a counterclockwise direction all the way around the city till in verse 32, they end up back at the Sheep Gate again. So the writer is looking around the whole city. And he's going to start here and he's going to work his way around. And who's doing what? The Sheep Gate just happened to be the gate closest to the temple. A lot of scholars think this is the gate through which the animals were brought into the city to be prepared for the sacrifice. It's not surprising that the priest who served the temple would take the lead in rebuilding this particular section of the wall. And then after they completed that section of the wall, they consecrated it to God. In other words, they set that section apart for God's use and God's glory. By giving the priest and that section of the wall the honor of being listed first, I believe the project's leaders were demonstrating the importance of keeping God's redemptive mission in the forefront. The temple represented the presence of God living among his people. The temple represented the place where sin was removed and forgiveness was offered and access to God was made possible. The temple represented the mission that God's people had to invite other people to come into this special relationship and be reconciled with God. And I think the lesson for us as a church here 2,500 years later is that when we try to build something for God, we too need to keep God's redemptive mission in the forefront. The church is not just another social club. It is not just another relief agency. It is not just another political movement. Now, the church can have some involvement in each of those spheres, but if any of them becomes our main focus, we have lost our way. As a church, we have to always remember that our main reason for being here, the reason Jesus established his church, was to invite other people to be reconciled with God and to show them what it looks like to live under the rule and reign of God. That's why we're here. In everything we do as a church, we need to strive to keep the main thing the main thing. By giving the priest and the work nearest the temple a place of prominence, I believe Nehemiah and his followers were seeking to do just that. Something else that becomes apparent as we examine how these people rebuilt the wall is they followed an organized plan. In verse 2, next to him, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zakur, the son of Imri, built. Now, and we can go on and on throughout the rest of this chapter. That phrase is mentioned throughout, and it moves counterclockwise around the city, all the way around the perimeter of ancient Jerusalem. The people did not simply just rush out and build haphazardly. They had studied the problem. They had a plan. Assignments were made. The work was carried out in an orderly fashion. How many churches today just simply see a need and rush out to address the problem without first taking the time to analyze it and come up with the best way to solve it? We just throw something on the wall and see what sticks. We get involved in this and this and this and this and this. There's no plan, no overall strategy. We just run around like the proverbial chickens with our heads cut off. Proverbs 19:2 says, "Also, it is not good for a person to be without knowledge, and he who hurries his footsteps errs." It pays sometimes to step back and study the problem and say, okay, what's the best way for us to address this? How has God called us to step into this situation? As Jesus himself said in John 14, verses 28 through 30, "For which of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and he's not able to finish, all who observe it began to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" Now, Jesus, of course, was speaking there specifically about counting the cost of becoming one of his followers, about making sure you know what you're getting yourself into, because being a disciple is a serious thing. But the principle applies to everything the church does. Have we correctly identified the real problem? Have we determined what the goal is? Have we developed a plan to get there? How will we know that we've accomplished the goal? What does the win look like? Of course, all good plans eventually devolve into work. You can have the best plans in the world, but if they stay on the shelf, they're not going to do any good, are they? You know, if you're all talk and no work, it's like I tell my kids sometimes, and I'm trying to talk them into doing something. Hey, let's have a little less talk, a little more action, you know? Because kids can come up with all kinds of excuses for stuff, as those of you who are parents full well know. There comes a point where you have to stop planning and start doing. And when the people of Jerusalem started doing the work, they saw the work through to completion. That's the third observation here. They saw the work through to completion. There's a phrase that pops up. It starts in verse 1, and it appears throughout the chapter. In verse 1, we see how the priests, they hung the doors when they finished their section of the wall. Jump down to verse 3. Now the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate, and they laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Jump down to verse 6. Joiada the son of Paseah and Meshulam the son of Besodeah repaired the old gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Jump down to verse 13. Hanun and the inhabitants of Zenoah repaired the valley gate. They built it and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars and 1,000 cubits of the wall to the refuse gate. And this goes on and on throughout the chapter. Now, in building the walls of an ancient city, the very last thing one did was to install the doors in the gate. In other words, this phrase is an indication that the various teams working on the wall saw their parts of the project through to completion. Churches are notorious for starting projects and never seeing them through. You ever notice that? That's mainly because we don't properly plan the project in the first place. See the previous point. What does a church communicate to its community about God when we fail to see things through? What are we telling our neighbors about God? We may not be sending the message that we think we're sending. One of the keys to seeing projects through was they each did their part. This is key. They each did their part. And we see that in verse 1 with the priests taking their section of the wall. We see it in verse 2 with the men of Jericho taking their section of the wall. And then Zakur, the son of Imri, taking his section. The sons of Hasanah, and so on and so forth throughout this entire chapter. Rebuilding the wall to a whole city. Think about this. Now, Jerusalem wasn't a huge city, but it wasn't a small town either. And you think about the possibility of building these huge walls around this entire city. That's a pretty overwhelming task. You ever been handed a job and you're like, man, there's no way. I just can't get my head around this. I just don't feel adequate for this. That's kind of like, you know, if you'd had called one person and said, okay, your job is to build a wall. Whoa! The project was accomplished by dividing the main task into smaller units and delegating responsibility to various groups within the city. In a lot of cases, these groups were assigned sections that were closest to their interests, like the priest, like some of the merchants, like others who were given sections that were close to where they lived. And these groups, when you look at this listing, they represent a pretty broad coalition that crossed social, economic, and ethnic lines. We've already seen in verse 1, the priests were involved. Some people might think normally the priests, they got busy work to do. They're important. They're praying. They're offering sacrifices. We shouldn't bother them. They led out. But not only that, we see, just going down the first few verses, we see teams from other cities coming in to help with the work. Places like Jericho, which is over near the Jordan River. We see places like from Tekoa, which is a whole different town. We see places like Gibeon, who weren't even Israelites. They were a group of people, Canaanites, that were already in the land, and when Joshua led the conquest in, the Gibeonites kind of played a little trick on them because they knew that God had told the Israelites to wipe out all the inhabitants. So they tricked the Israelites into thinking they had actually come from somewhere else. And so Joshua agreed to let them, to make a treaty with them, then found out later, no, these guys are from near Jerusalem. God was a little upset with that, but because they'd given their word, so what happened is the Gibeonites became servants to the Israelites. And so this is a place not even primarily led by Jews. It was a Canaanite city, but they're sending teams in to help rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. We also see members of various professional guilds taking part. In verse 8, next to him, Uzziel, the son of Hariah of the goldsmiths, made repairs. In other words, the guild of craftsmen that worked with gold, they took part of the wall. Next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, made repairs. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad street. So we see two or three different groups that led these professional guilds that took time out of their business to help rebuild the wall. We see members or government officials taking part. In verse 10, next to them, Jedidiah, the son of Harumaph, made repairs opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of, let me back up in verse 9. Next to them, Raphaiah, the son of Hur, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. In other words, he was like a precinct captain, deputy mayor, so to speak, of part of Jerusalem was divided itself into neighborhoods, and he was like a borough president, okay? He was a leader of part of the city of Jerusalem. We see some other city officials down here who are in verse 12. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, the guy on the other half of town. He made repairs, he and his daughters. So, and there we see a man who actually involves his daughters in the work. He didn't have any sons, but he let his daughters get involved in helping lead some of this. So all different kinds of people come across different lines to take part in this project. And by working in cooperation, these groups were able to accomplish more together than any one of them could do on their own. A couple of thoughts on that. I don't want to take up too much time on it. One, you saw a video just a minute ago about the power of cooperation. That's why we as a church participate with Southern Baptists and with Tennessee Baptists, because the theory is we can do more working together than any one church can do on its own. You know, I had lunch with a couple of pastors about a year ago, and they were from different denominations. The conversation came up, one of the guys was asked, how many missionaries does your church support? Well, we managed to support about three or four. And the other guy was from a little larger church, and his question was, well, how many do you support? He said, well, we support about 70. So they turned to me, how many does your church support? And I said, well, last count, close to 9,000. Because when we give money to the cooperative program, along with all the other churches in our network, we are making incredible things possible. And nobody, I mean, there's not, and this is a popular misconception I have to clear up. There's nobody in Nashville telling us how to run our church. We're a local, autonomous congregation. We choose to participate to add our efforts to the efforts of about 40,000 other churches around the country, about 5,000 churches here in the state of Tennessee, because we can do more working together than any one of us can do on our own. And the most somebody in an office in Nashville or Atlanta or something can do, they can say, well, we're not going to take your money because you're outside the parameters that we've agreed to. This church is not going to happen, thankfully. But that's the most they can tell us to do. We are a local congregation, and we're free to operate the way we see fit. But we choose to cooperate because we can do more together than we can apart. It also works inside the church. This last 18 months, a handful of us have had to take on some extra hats. And one of the things I'm convinced of, you know, we're at a point now where we're trying to, you know, open up and broaden up. But some of us who've had to take on those hats, we're becoming like bottlenecks. And it's just reinforced to me that if you have to rely on a small number of people to do everything, you're only going to be able to do up to the limit of those people. So we desperately, desperately, desperately need to pass some of these hats off to other qualified people so that we can expand the work and continue to grow. That's why we've got a nominating committee set up. We haven't got them cranked up yet. We're going to be doing that soon. But they're going to be helping us recruit people to take on some of those roles. We have a couple of staff positions that we need to fill. Right now, that's really, really hard to do thanks to COVID. It's kind of, you think Chick-fil-A and McDonald's are having trouble finding people to work? It's a hard to do, but we've got some staff positions we need to fill. So some of us can take off some of these hats and hand them off to somebody else. But we do more by delegating and spreading that responsibility out than we do by a handful of people keeping it all under control. Here's something really key. They refuse to let critics discourage them. Look at verse 5. Moreover, next to him, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the work of their masters. You know, every project has its share of those who'd rather tear down than build up. Every project has its share of those who would rather tear down than build up. Those of you who've been involved in leadership, have you discovered that? Yeah. In verse 5, we read about a group of nobles. These were like, you know, some of the rich people from Tekoa who didn't support the work, even though the work had the approval of the government and the work had the support of their fellow Tekoites. Remember, Tekoa is a separate town from Jerusalem, okay? Now, it may be that this figure we read about at the end of chapter 2, Geshem the Arab, Tekoa kind of fell under his territory that was under his influence. They may have been worried that if they're building up Jerusalem, since he's opposed to the project, he may cut them off. These guys probably have business contacts with him. They're afraid those are going to dry up. But their neighbors, the other Tekoites, they were in favor of this, of building the city back up. So these people who were against the project, maybe we're not told exactly why. Maybe they didn't agree with the project, or maybe they simply saw the work as beneath them. But what is amazing is that the resistance of these nobles didn't stop the rest of their people from supporting the work enthusiastically. We read in verse 5, these people carried out the work that was assigned to them. But not only that, jump down to verse 27. After them, the Tekoites repaired another section in front of the great projecting tower as far as the wall of the Ophel. So these folks not only did the first section that was assigned to them, I mean, these aren't even people who live in Jerusalem. But they believed in what was happening. They came in to help out alongside. They built the section that was assigned to them. They got that done. Hey, give us more work to do. And they took on another section of the wall to build it. Some problems you work through, others you have to work around. Now, any organization that attempts to make substantive change is going to encounter internal resistance. We already read about the external resistance in the last chapter, but now they're encountering internal resistance. One would like to think that churches could find a way to be in agreement about everything they do. The sad truth is, in most churches, there's usually at least one individual or group that resists change, that doesn't want to get with the program. Sometimes they have legitimate reasons, sometimes they don't. Part of learning to be good leaders is learning how to navigate that resistance. Optimally, you figure out a way to convince the holdouts to come on board. Okay? That's the best case scenario. Sadly, though, there are some people who are just going to refuse to be convinced. Steve Jobs is famous for saying, I don't know if he originated this, but it's often attributed to him, if you want to please everybody, don't be a leader. Go sell ice cream. If the prospect of change is creating division, the leaders may have to make a hard choice about who they'd rather take with them for the rest of the journey. In this case, the people of Tekoa decided to cast their lot with the people of Jerusalem over their own nobility. Not only were they dealing with the critics, they were able to embrace necessary change. This is a little harder to see unless you zoom out here. There's a subtle but significant change in this narration between verses 1 through 15 and verses 16 through 32. Okay? Note that in verses 1 through 15, and maybe you saw this in the passages that we dipped into here, the landmarks typically are given in reference to city gates. They built a section of the wall around this gate, or this group built a section of the wall around that gate. When you get to verse 16, though, especially from 16 to 27, and really all the way through 32, we see fewer gates being used as landmarks and more homes of prominent individuals who are being used as landmarks. Why is that? Well, when you analyze where the ones we can figure out where some of these homes are located, it suggests there's an important reason for this shift. Many of the homes mentioned as landmarks are the ones that we can identify were located in that or near that section of the city that had collapsed down the hillside. We talked about this when we looked at chapter 2. Part of Jerusalem originally had been built out when the city had been built up under Solomon, and some of those kings had been built out on a promontory. And when the Babylonians pulled the walls down, that collapsed. Those, not just the walls, but a lot of those buildings collapsed. That was the part in Nehemiah 2, verses 14 through 15, where Nehemiah was trying to, you know, he couldn't get his donkey through there, and then he had to come around another way. So what happened is, instead of trying to reclaim the fallen section, Nehemiah and his people decided to abandon it, and they rerouted the wall accordingly. So instead of going by the old gates, they instead cut around by some of these homes, these estates. Couple reasons for doing that that scholars have speculated about over the centuries. The population of Jerusalem, for one, was much smaller than it had been in the days leading up to the Babylonian invasion. Therefore, they didn't have enough people to accommodate that larger area. A few years ago, I had a chance to spend a couple days up in Detroit. Those of you who know the history of Detroit, Detroit used to be one of the largest cities in America in the heydays of the car industry. But then when in the 70s and 80s and 90s, when the car industry took a nosedive, Detroit basically became a ghost town. You don't have to worry about rush hour traffic much in Detroit right now because they built it for a city of certain size and they got about half that population living there now. And the city's starting to build back, but there's abandoned buildings, abandoned whole blocks all over the place because they have far too few people to sustain a city of that footprint. Well, that's what's happening in Jerusalem here. They got far fewer people to sustain the footprint of the city, so they draw the boundaries in a little bit. Also, the expense and difficulty of reclaiming that fallen section may have been seen as an unreasonable demand on the city's resources. Sometimes rebuilding involves making tough choices about what to reclaim and what to let go of. As I mentioned, sometimes as churches, we have to make that decision. I know of a church in another place that has a beautiful building. It was during the 60s, this church was in a neighborhood that was thriving and growing. And this church has this beautiful Gothic building that seats about 500. The neighborhood changed. They weren't able to keep up with the change. The church began to decline. And now this congregation has this big, beautiful Gothic stone building that seats about 500. They have about 50 people who meet there. It's kind of hard for 50 people to take care of a building that seats 500. But they refuse to relocate somewhere else. And that actually is a pretty common story across the country. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in our traditions and our memories, we can't let go of things even though we can no longer maintain them. Thankfully, we are not in that position. But it may be that as we try to rebuild and restructure in this new era that we live in, there may be things that we look at and we say, you know what? Restarting this might be too big a drain on our resources. Those resources might be better spent doing this over here. We may have to make those tough choices about some things. Times have changed. They are continuing to change. And to survive, we may need to make some changes ourselves, and we need to have the courage and the faith to be willing to do that. But change is hard. I know. In a world that seems to where everything is changing all the time, a lot of folks look to church as the constant. The church is safe. It's familiar. That's where my family is. And it makes me feel stable. I get that. But we want this church to be here for the next generation and the generation after that as well. And that sometimes means we may have to give up a little bit of that sense of safety and security in order to prepare our church to be ready to face the future. They were willing to sacrifice part of the city in order to save the city. They were also willing to do more than their share. This is huge. I've already mentioned earlier the men of Tekoa repaired more than one section of the wall. But they weren't the only ones. Look at verse 4. Next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, made repairs. Next to him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshebabel, made repairs. Now, jump down to verse 21. Remember that name and jump down to verse 21. After him, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the doorway of Eliashib's house, even as far as the end of his house. And we see this a couple different places. There were people who, after they finished their section, they said, give me another one. Man, what it'd be like to have people like that. Hey, give me a job. Where can I plug in? Where can I make the biggest impact? When you got a bunch of people who don't care about, well, that's not my job, or I don't do that kind of work, those kind of attitudes will kill any organization, especially a church. When you got people who are willing to jump in and do whatever, whenever, who are saying, man, just give me something to do, let me contribute, you can change the world. Give us enough people with that kind of attitude, and man, you will see things happen. Here's another thing that's really important that I don't think we do nearly well enough. They recognized those who served well. In verse 20, after him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the doorway of the house of Eliashib the high priest. Nehemiah singles out men like Baruch, the son of Zabai. That word he zealously repaired. What high praise. When people make a contribution, when people do above and beyond, we need to recognize that. There are people in this church that serve faithfully, and a lot of times under the radar, they don't ask for any attention. But we need to recognize when people do well in serving. A lot of times, you know, I get a lot of the focus. I have to be honest, it sometimes makes me a little uncomfortable because it ain't all about me. Okay, and I appreciate it. In August, you guys blessed us. You were very generous, not only as a church, but also individually. And I am very appreciative of that. But I very much believe it's not just about me. It is a team effort. And we need to recognize, when, you know, everybody loves a pat on the back when they do a job well, don't they? Let's make sure we're doing that. Even if it's just saying thank you to somebody. I'll tell you somebody right now that I want to say express for is Pat Lenz, chairs our building committee. Man, when I came here, there were a bunch of projects that the building committee had on their docket that had sat there for a while. It's kind of those things where it got to be the point it was overwhelming. And a couple of years in, when Pat became chairman of that committee, I said, Pat, here's what you do. Make a list of those projects and then prioritize them. And just start knocking them out one at a time. You know why he did that? He's done that. And we have been able to do, it opened up a lot of things that happened under his leadership. We were able to get the renovations of the sound booth, we were able to get the projection screen, other little things around here. He didn't start the playground project, but he is well on the way to getting that completed, and I appreciate that. And that's on top of helping run our Sunday school ministry the last few years. We need to recognize when people do a job well done. Greg has worked with our students under most difficult circumstances over the last 18 months, when it's a lot of times it's so hard to even get kids together. Even if you do something, doesn't mean kids are going to show up. And he is faithful. He and his team have faithfully served in that. Our children's ministry team, a lot of times you don't see them out of sight, out of mind. I took a bunch of pictures today. We're going to put them on Facebook. But they have been working hard back there in the back to make sure that ministry continues for our kids under very difficult circumstances. Right about the time you start to get some momentum built up, people start getting sick, and you got to pull back a little bit. On top of that, they're all volunteers right now. They've got a full calendar plan for this fall for stuff for our kids, and I'm very excited about that. I'm appreciative of those folks. There are others in this church that serve so well, and we need to make sure we are recognizing that. There's a lot of talk today about how divided our nation is. People actively wonder, how can our country go on when the extremes keep moving farther and farther apart? Sadly, that spirit of divisiveness has infected even some churches. However, it is possible to rise above the division and to come together to make great things happen. This weekend, as people have been reflecting over the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, one of the remarkable things, if you'll remember, that occurred in the aftermath of those attacks is people came together. People came together to do relief work, to join the military, in all kinds of ways, they came together. Yesterday, former President George W. Bush spoke at the memorial in Pennsylvania for the passengers of Flight 93. If you remember, Flight 93 was the fourth plane that was hijacked on 9/11. And experts think the hijackers intended to crash that plane somewhere in Washington, maybe the White House, maybe the Congressional Building, we don't know. However, at some point, the passengers on that flight figured out what was going on, and they decided to rush the hijackers and retake the plane, knowing full well that attempt could cost them their lives. And sadly enough, when the hijackers saw what the passengers were doing, they intentionally crashed the plane in Pennsylvania rather than allow it to be retaken. Near the end of his remarks, and I encourage you, if you haven't seen those, to go back and watch those, especially the last 3 or 4 minutes, because he began to recount some of the current lines of division afflicting our country right now. And he followed each description with the phrase, "But that's not the America I know." Followed by a reflection of something he observed in this country about the way that Americans came together 20 years ago. It was very moving. Today, a lot of people like to criticize the church. I don't necessarily mean specifically this church, but churches in general. churches in general are taking it on the chin very seriously these days, both from within and from without. I like to say that whether those criticisms have merit or not, that's not the church that I know. Because the church that I know does amazing things when people come together. The church I know sends people out to clean up disasters. The church I know feeds the hungry. The church I know takes care of kids and shares the gospel and reminds them that Jesus loves them very much. The church I know tells teenagers there's a purpose and a hope in life. The church I know comforts the dying and visits people on their deathbeds to let them know they're not forgotten. The church I know sends missionaries all over the world, not just focused on their own immediate needs, but sending people out to take the good news of Jesus everywhere. That's the church I know. Perhaps it's time to stop listening to those critics, to stop harping on our divisions, and to start focusing on the thing we have in common, the mission Jesus gave us to go out and make disciples, to be his hands and feet in this world. And when our neighbors see that, may they stand in awe of what our God can do.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.